You are listening to SAC Urban Dharma Podcast. For more information about weekly classes, retreats, and workshops in the Sacramento area, please visit our Facebook page or our website at sacurbandharma.org. Soundtrack provided by Mount Sinai from the album Beyond Words.
Crossed, hands folded, closed my eyes. From the base of my spine up, I feel my energy rise. Through seven chakras out the crown, I connect with the sky. Firmly rooted in the earth, I become that which don't die. The mind finds silence, finally stop the chatter. Stop processing data, and that which don't matter. Shatter bad attitudes and platitudes. Practice gratitude and elevate spiritual attitudes. Massive dues must be paid. We're not wage slaves, but we work just the same. Spend our days digging our graves. I focus on rebirth right now in the current moment. Try to always be aware without claiming I know it. Can't hold it, let it go, let it flow as the saying goes. I only ask for wisdom, and as far as praying goes, I bow my head and ask, please deliver patience. No matter how long I travel, I'm on the path to liberation. I'm going home. Clear, a path emerges up the spine, energy surges up the spine, it opens the third eye. Word, I climb as Kundalini, like Naga through the Nadi. Seven bodies I fight in through samsara towards samadhi. In a moment of peace, I see things not for what they seem, but what they are like steam. I purify the unclean. From Brahma to Shiva, the two world is at Veda. It's all one in the eyes of the destroyer and creator, who made you all, manifested his freshness. Every living being I see as God's investments. Blessed beats in our hearts, seeds of wisdom in our minds. The dark side becomes light once it's been purified, electrified. The aura, pour out your soul. Know yourself. See, the journey is the goal. You've been blessed with breath, and the steps are pranayama on a path to self-realization. Like Yogananda, we're going home.
Piece of research that I saw recently that caught my attention, and the article was titled "The End of History Illusion." And what the research was is they asked, it was tens of thousands of people. They said some people, they said, they take, for example, like a 20-year-old and say, how much are you going to change over the next decade? Right? And then they'd ask a 30-year-old, how much did you change over the past decade? Right? So some people are saying how much they will change, some people are saying how much they did change. And then they analyze the data and the basic conclusion they came to is that people anticipated a lot less change than actually happened. So this is what they said. People, it seems, regard the present as a watershed moment at which they have finally become the person they will be for the rest of their lives. History, it seems, is always ending today. Now that really caught my attention because it resonated with what the Buddha said, that the default position of our mind is to imagine permanence rather than impermanence. To imagine stability instead of changingness. And in our own meditation practice, there's something like an adjustment to the changingness of our moment-by-moment experience. New York Times picked up this story and interviewed a professor about this. So this is what he says. Dr. McAdams was reminded of a conversation with his four-year-old daughter during the craze for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in the 1980s. When he told her they might not be her favorite thing one day, she refused to acknowledge the possibility. But later in her 20s, she confessed to him that some part of her four-year-old mind had realized he might be right. Dr. McAdams says, she resisted the idea of change as it dawned on her at age four because she couldn't imagine what else would ever substitute for the turtles. She had a sneaking suspicion that she'd change, but she couldn't quite imagine how, so she stood with her assertion of continuity. Maybe something like this goes on with all of us. So, in our own lives, in our own practices, it can be helpful to look at the ways in which we imagine continuity, the ways in which it's difficult to imagine change, the ways in which it's difficult to imagine the openness of the moment. In our meditation practice, at some level, we're practicing standing at the edge, the very front edge of our lives, and opening again and again to the unknown present. Like, what will arise next? Because we know how things kind of work and we can project into the future, it feels like we know, but we really don't. And meditation is coming to appreciate this, that kind of radical openness of not knowing what's next. So as we practice tonight, we can again and again come back to that sense of falling into this unknown present, and perhaps there can be two experiences that arise in the face of that. One is a sense of wanting some ground, wanting some stability, wanting some solidity, wanting to project the past into the future and reassure ourselves who we are and what we're becoming and what meditation practice is. And then another experience as we stand at the edge of our lives is one of a real radical openness. And everything in our lives looks a little bit different, feels a little bit different from that place of not knowing, from that place of falling into the moment. So, can take a posture that feels sustainable. Thank you. perhaps taking a few deep breaths. And relaxing whatever can be relaxed. Area around the eyes or the jaw. The shoulders or the belly. But if some tension remains, just allow it to remain. Of course, if you have a meditation practice that you normally do, feel free to treat my voice as sound in the background. As we begin a period of practice, it can be good to take the pulse of the mind a bit. What kinds of moods and attitudes are flavoring this moment? Anger, fear, sadness, joy, interest, peace. Getting a sense of the inner landscape, because that which goes unnoticed flavors experience. maybe skillful to use the breath as an anchor for the attention. The breath as the gateway to some sense of presence. So you may place the attention, the mouth or nose, the belly, or broadly across the body. Sensing the rhythm, the breath coming and going. Be skillful to try to be precise about when the inhale begins and ends, when the exhale begins and ends. We can bring that sense of not knowing, that sense of openness, the sense of standing at the front edge of our lives, not knowing what will come of us. We can bring that to the breath. Offering our attention, a sort of open-hearted attention to the breath. Thank you. thinking is not an enemy in any sense, but it creates a sense of stability, of continuity, a sense of already being familiar with the moment. So when we notice we're submerged in the stream of thinking, we gently but intently direct the attention back to the breath and body. Surrendering to the changingness of the breath. The openness of the moment. Falling into the present again and again. Be open to the world, the heart needs to be soft. needs to feel okay to be vulnerable to the human condition. To be willing to be touched by the world. By thoughts and feelings. To allow all of that to arise and pass away. Remaining undefended to this present moment. Not trying to make anything happen. Or improve ourselves. Solve a problem, just offering the attention moment by moment. this to practice with you. And with these kind of meditation instructions and with Dharma instructions generally, you're really encouraged to see what resonates and pick that up and explore and then leave the rest behind. The image I had about giving meditation instructions, it's a little bit like picking up a handful of darts and throwing them all at once at the dartboard. And a lot of them just kind of like are going to bounce off the board, and, you know, but a few maybe. So any questions about what arose for you in practice, or questions about Buddhist psychology in your life and practice? Of awkward silence here, so yeah. The Buddhist interpretation of impermanence?
Remembrance.
Oh, remembrance? Say what you mean by self-remembrance. Remembrance, yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not certain which scriptures you're pointing to, but I can say in the the Pali tradition, the kind of original recorded suttas of the Buddha, which of course were not written down for several hundred years after, they were really an oral tradition for a long time. But in those suttas, the word for mindfulness, sati, is sometimes translated as remembering. And there are many different ways of talking about mindfulness, but one of them is something like remember. As we practice, it may feel like that as we move through our day or in an individual meditation practice. Mindfulness is something like the capacity to remember the moment, we could say. It's one sense of remembrance. I'll say one other and then I'll check in and see whether it's hitting on what you're asking about. The Dharma, meaning these teachings, this kind of unfolding, to me often feels like insight when it arises, when we come to a new sense of who we are or what the human condition is like or what it is, how we can suffer less and feel more free. Often those insights feel more like remembering something than arriving at something new. And so Dharma teachings can feel a little bit like it's the teacher maybe just kind of connecting some dots and pointing to things that you already have some vague intuitive sense of. Like this is in my practice, a lot of times when I come to some sense of of insight, it's kind of like, oh yeah, I knew that. I kind of knew that. And then a new clarity arises. And this is another sense of remembering. I have a feeling, though, what you're asking about is something that I'm not familiar with. Can you say a little bit more?
That's included in all of that.
Yeah. A lot of Buddhist teachings are we're encouraged to be reflective, and you know, a lot of times people get this idea like thinking gets a bad name in meditation circles, right? And probably in your own mind, right? It's like, you know, touch, sight, sound, those things, that's okay, but thinking, that ain't right, you know, like. Even though in the Buddhist psychology is one of the six senses, right? So it gets a bad name, but in a lot of the traditions, we're actively encouraged to be contemplating, reflecting, remembering as you're talking about in our daily lives. And as we practice more and more, it's like more and more reminds us of the Dharma. More and more calls us back. More and more we see the teachings manifesting moment by moment in our lives. We may see the Four Noble Truths manifest, and that's a common frame that people use for remembering. And the fortunate thing is that as we practice more and more, there's a kind of momentum. Just in the same way that there's a momentum of unconsciousness, there's also a momentum of clarity and open-heartedness and equanimity. And so it's not like we have to be like, oh, I'm supposed to be mindful and kind now. Right? It's not an event like that. It's like something deep in us. There's a momentum towards remembering, towards knowing our lives as the Dharma, knowing our lives as a spiritual unfolding. Well, one way of just experimenting with what's willful thinking and what's not willful thinking is to stop willing it and see what stops.
Right.
Some of your thinking will stop and most of it won't. And if you get into the battle with that second kind of thinking, it's like fighting with the sound of the vent, right? It's like, it's just as doomed a fight. So This is it's kind of the first point of meditation practice, but it's remarkable how many times we actually need to hear this and to catch ourselves doing the opposite. But I'll say it, we are not trying to manufacture an experience, but to know what is arising and passing. The mind will do all these, like, scheme in all these ways and try to rationalize itself in all these ways meant to manufacture something. Even, I think, decades into practice, people can get stuck in trying to make things happen, trying to manipulate the moment. And a lot of our practice learning is seeing the different ways in which we've been trying to make something happen. That happens at more and more subtle levels.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with my practice too. A lot of times I sit and I expect, you know, I have expectations that this will calm me down and I'll be able to, you know, put all thoughts aside. I will feel good afterwards and then afterwards. I don't always feel, you know, that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, my mind tends to do that.
Sure. Yeah, and that it's very, that sort of, that basic bargain is what gets us to do things. It's like, okay, I'll do something, but pay me, you know, or like whatever in our mind, like give me the, you know, like, okay, I'll sit down for half an hour, but what do I get, right?
Yeah.
And meditation does, that's the tricky thing, is that meditation brings so much, but it brings it by allowing it just to be what it is. And so you want to be real careful when you start to make the deal of like, you do the meditation practice and then you get some particular feeling at the end. Sometimes it's like that. Sometimes meditation will tend to settle us and it'll have this self-reinforcing effect. It's like, oh, I feel better. Even if the meditation might have been kind of bumpy or something, you may feel good afterwards. But be careful what kind of bargains you get into, because then it sets up some more pain.
See, I know that going into that, but it's real subtle, though.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Sometimes you don't even realize that. Set yourself up, and then, you know, afterwards it's like, oh, that wasn't real productive, you know.
Yeah. So what, you know, watch the whole evaluation process around practice. The Dalai Lama said every, you know, you want to evaluate your practice maybe every 5 or 10 years. We do it after every breath, right?
Yeah.
It's like, we take a breath and then it's like, what did I learn? Am I calmer? Am I more enlightened? Am I, you know, more concentrated? Is my thought quieter? And, you know, after every breath, after every meditation, after every day, you know, it's like we really have to hold that very carefully. And it's not to say we never look to our lives. We should be gradually over time feeling less suffering, feeling less in the grips of greed, hatred, and delusion. Over time, that's true, but we really got to be careful what kind of bargains and expectations we make.
It's, you know, that thinking that's real subtle, though.
Sure.
It up on you,
sure. So you listened, you know, it's mostly in the form thinking we could break down into mental pictures and internal talk. Sometimes it's a combination of both mental pictures and internal talk, but it's often the subtle internal talk that is sort of disguised. It like comes, like flies under the radar of awareness. And when it does that, we just take it as the ultimate truth. When thinking flies under the radar of mindfulness, we take it really, we hear it like we would hear the voice of God or something. Not like just me and my silly little thinking process, right? So we do need to be like as the mindfulness becomes more refined, we start to, we could say, hear more and more of what we believe, and that starts to free the heart.
I can't even think that's even should be considered a problem, especially good thing that you can see that coming. Some people get a lot of thoughts, words, and things that are going on in them, and they don't even know those are going on. So it's a good thing you can see that.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could address the philosophy of Against the Stream, the Sangha, and because I've been reading Noah's books, and he, when he talks about naming the Sangha, he references it not just in the time of the Buddha, because the whole idea of going against grasping and aversion and materialism was a contemporary, very revolutionary at that time. But he also frames it in today and talks, he references a kind of corruption of spiritual practice, the way it's practiced now, but he doesn't really talk about it specifically. So I wonder if you could talk about Against the Stream, the Sangha, his approach, philosophy, demographics, just kind of how Against the Stream differs from many of the other sanghas that you visit.
Well, I, you know, in some ways, even though I've been practicing and teaching in that community, I don't really feel empowered to, you know, as a kind of representative of Noah. I don't have a sense exactly what he would say, but I can say a few things. You know, my own feeling is, and my own practice background is very mixed and eclectic, and I was attracted to the Against the Stream community because I knew that in my other practice, my other teacher is, most teachers fall somewhere on either the wisdom side or the compassion side. That's a general tendency. There are very few teachers that I feel are really balanced. Most really, they have a strength, and most of them are willing to say that. That's not an embarrassment. The teacher that I had, Shinzen Young, very much on the wisdom side, I would say, where the thrust of the practice is always to seek everything. All phenomena are like a rabbit hole to insight into emptiness, into the insubstantial, flowing, vanishing nature of phenomena, and the realization of egolessness. That is a beautiful and core part of this path. And without that insight, the path is not very liberatory. But at the same time, I had this intuition, like my practice is not balanced. And Noah, I would say, is, for me, has been more of on the heart side, the compassion side. And I was initially attracted to the Sangha because, now I'm like, it's Dharma punks. And if I'm anything, I'm like a nerd. You know? And, so it's like, and sometimes when I would when teaching, people would come and it's like punk rock. And I don't even know who the Adolescents or Motorhead is, or the Cure, Clash, or, you know, like, I don't know anything about music or that scene or anything. And people would just be like, who is this guy? Who is Matthew? What is he doing here? Right. But I, you know, so I have like no cultural reference, like to a lot of Noah's life history. But there was a real kinship with the sincerity of the people practicing. That's what I sensed. And that's really the lifeblood of this practice for me, this sincerity. And so in that community, there was really, there's not a lot of sense of what gets called spiritual materialism, which is a little bit what Noah was pointing to, the sense of spiritual practice becoming another badge for the ego, you know. Yes. So it's like Matthew the Buddhist or whatever, you know, like whatever, all the ways that the ego crystallizes around anything. That's a strong force in spiritual life. Part of what attracted me to Against the Stream was that people were suffering, I would say, more than average. And that kind of suffering created a certain honesty and sincerity and a willingness to expose the heart to the Dharma, to take some risks. That was my initial connection with it. Noah's got, you know, Noah, the, you know, Against the Stream. There are only, I think, two times in the suttas where that phrase actually appears. But one of them, the Buddha is saying something like, this path, for people who, it gets translated in different ways. I think Stephen Batchelor translated it something like, for people who love their place, love their ground, this path is very difficult to see. It goes against the stream. This path is very difficult to see for people who love their place. And that's where that phrase comes from, against the stream. Against greed, hatred, and delusion, sometimes the way Noah talks about it. So those are a few things. Does that speak to what you're wondering?
Great answer, thank you. Okay. Yeah, I had read, I'll just briefly, there's this book called What Really Matters, and this guy has a chapter on Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield.
Yeah.
And he talks about them almost exactly in the same way that you talked about the wisdom and compassion. Mm-hmm. That Goldstein is a very heady, non-attached approach to Buddhism, where Kornfield is very much from the more compassionate side. Mm-hmm. And your answer is true. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I'll just, one other thing is, it's part of what I've been feeling motivated by recently is encouraging people to be exposed to different teachers, because I know from my own practice history, it's easy to allow, to cultivate certain sort of aspects of the heart with one teacher and leave other parts neglected. But when you hear different voices and when you practice with some sincerity in different ways, it tends to expose you to different and uncomfortable parts of oneself that is quite helpful. And so some people may very naturally gravitate towards the wisdom side or the compassion side, and it's great to bring yourself into the something that doesn't always feel as natural, and to see what happens, see what ways it catalyzes some growth. Yeah, maybe one more, and then we'll take a break. Yeah.
You mentioned something about phenomena being really eradicable.
Yeah.
And it bringing incarnation or realization about egolessness.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that means. And I'm wondering, does it have something to do with the concept of lack of duality?
Yeah. This is something that, you know, talking about this, it's not like, some people say it's ineffable, you can't talk about it or something. And I don't really buy that exactly. I think you can talk about this stuff, but it's hard and slippery, and it can only ever point to a direct experience. And the mind, when it starts hearing about selflessness and egolessness, it, like, the mind kicks into overdrive, because it's like, wait a second, you're telling me I don't exist, or I don't exist in the way I think? And the mind's like, hey, F you, I'm going to get thinking, you know, it's like, I'm going to figure this out. Like, okay, if I don't exist, blah, 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 you know, and just like, it's a lot of thinking, basically. And it all arises in, out of the mind's attempt to inoculate itself against the fear of groundlessness, the fear of egolessness. So it's weird to talk about. But
is it weird because of the potential reaction of others to close down?
No, you know, weird is probably a bad word. It's not weird. It's sometimes there's just limited value talking about it. Mostly it's just like, okay, let's practice together. But it's good to hear a bit. And so when I was saying a rabbit hole into to emptiness, the way that some people teach is that we have these senses and these thoughts and emotional life, and rather than trying to understand them or integrate them or heal ourselves, everything is a phenomena that arises and passes away. And if we can infuse the phenomenal world, which is really all there is from our perspective, we can infuse that with enough mindfulness and clarity and open-heartedness, then the solidity of things, the way we take self to be here and world to be there, that there's a kind of figure ground reversal, and there is often the way that it's described is that it's like it does point to some of that, your comment about duality and non-duality, that it's like the insight is something like the front edge of our perspective falling away and rejoining the world in a way, as a part of life, as a part of nature, and the kind of sense of that there's like some being in here, like the little Matthew that stands back and receives experience, that falls away. And in that falling away, we realize that we've been essentially protecting a phantom all of our lives, and that this very profoundly has constrained our life. And so it gives birth to a different way of living. And I think across a wide range of traditions, people do talk about the perennial mystical experience of non-separation or something like that. Yeah. And then the before we close, I'll just say that that is very much, even though that's on the quote wisdom side, that's very much related to love in a number of ways. Anyway, so let's take maybe 5 minutes, and then for tea, and come back, and I'll share a bit. Okay, thanks. So we just got about 15 minutes, but I will do kind of abbreviated talk. The subject is around mindfully relating, speaking, listening. And is a subject that it's a real, you know, critical place of practice. The Dharma, these teachings, it kind of wants to occupy all of our lives, like all of it. It's a little, the image I have is a little bit like, it's like a wildfire kind of, and it wants to like consume more and more of our life. And that's good. That's an important part of practice, to let it burn, to let it consume more and more of our lives. And so it starts maybe in this very, our practice is kind of very carefully circumscribed, and it's like, okay, it's about this sitting period right now, but more and more it just wants all of your life. And in speaking and acting, this speaking and listening, this is a great place to practice. Now, it's in this relating, it's such rich terrain, because we are deeply relational beings. We're deeply relational beings. I was reminded of a story of this pediatrician and psychoanalyst therapist who was at some conference, and he just said, there's no such thing as a baby. Huh. And people are just like, you know, to a group of pediatricians, they're like, are you high? You know, whatever. And I was like, no such thing as a baby. And he went on to say, there's only a baby and their mother or their caretaker. And that is true, because we humans are born kind of like way too early, basically. And it's not like we're like a reptile that hatches and then they're ready to like party after like 10 seconds, you know, they're like ready to hunt and stuff. We are born and are extremely, you know, our life depends on the care of another human being. Our life is like dependent on relationship. And so it is it's such a rich terrain for our practice. We can sometimes get carried away with meditation experiences. You know, people get turned sort of different meditation experiences into like a, almost like a fetish. It's like, okay, I did this, I had that experience, I had this, jhanas, a meditative absorption, I know, you know, had this insight, that. The rubber hits the road when you start talking to people, though, right? And it's a beautiful and humbling place of practice. Now, many different teachings are relevant here. We could say sila, samadhi, panya, conduct, mind training, unification of mind, and wisdom. They're all relevant. I'll just highlight a few ways in which these things are relevant in our time. Joseph Goldstein, I was on a retreat with him recently, and he was asked how to practice in daily life, and he said three things. He said, have a daily sitting practice, to pick up some spiritual virtue and, you know, make practice out of that. So like pick up themes of generosity or renunciation or kindness, and maybe just turn some attention to that in your daily life for a month or something. And then the third thing he said is he makes wise speech a central part of his practice. And wise speech is a whole, you know, it's a whole
talk or series of talks really in itself, but very, you know, the skeleton is, you can think of a few characteristics. Is the speech true, kind, and timely? If it meets those three criteria, that wipes out a lot of our trash talking, like a lot of our talking, period. True, kind, timely. Good litmus test to just check, And you know, this is, should not feel like a big repressive kind of thing where we're just holding everything in or something. And there are times we may need to vent. But when I, you know, when I vent, I'm like kind of, I'm kind of listening for the holes in the logic of my venting. You know, like I, it's not like I'm like, sometimes I do need to just say something, you know, and with a loved one or something, like I need to talk about something. But as I'm spinning, I'm not trying to like reinforce the logic of my venting, but actually to hear the holes in it. We can do that and be really careful, with our speech. It is a very beautiful thing to offer that kind of safety. It really is. It's a form of safety to people. I have one friend who, he's like the only person I've ever met whose speech is basically always like those true, kind, timely. You know, he's like, I don't know whether he's made it his practice, but he's really careful with it. And I only, it sort of only dawned on me recently that how careful he is with his speech. But it does, it creates such a sense of ease in me just to be around that and to know that he's caring for all beings in that way of not talking trash and just being really respectful of the impact that words have. This is speech. We are also learning to listen deeply. And to listen deeply is similarly a very deep offering and a kind of gift. And it calls upon the same skills that we develop in meditation of concentration and groundedness. Concentration, so we notice when the, like when we're doing meditation with the, on the breath, we know that we're sustaining the attention, we're detecting mind wandering, and when we detect mind wandering, we're practicing redirecting the attention to the breath. Same thing with conversation, actually. We're learning actually to sustain, to offer the attention more in a more continuous way, to detect when the mind is wandering and to return the attention to the conversation that we're having. Now, sometimes it can be helpful to let the mind go a little bit, right? Sometimes we're actually, a lot of our intuition and learning comes when we learn to listen to the mind and body in a very subtle and sensitive way when we're interacting with somebody. So it's not like we have to just singularly devote the attention to them. We learn to be sensitive to what's arising in our mind and body without getting completely lost in it. And sometimes we're just going to have some like stray thought like, I want pizza, right? Okay. Redirect, right? But sometimes it's like, there's something wrong here. Or this person, or you, we have actually an insight that may be helpful for that person, right? So it's not like we have to be like very tyrannical and moving the attention back, back, back. But we are learning to offer the attention in a deep way and to feel grounded in our own bodies and deeply sensitive to our bodies, but relaxed in our bodies as we listen. This is a way, this combination of sustained attention, the concentration, and the groundedness, the openness, makes it so that we can offer a very profound way of being with somebody, where we're not so much our own egoic pressure is not. It's not pushing on the other person. Do you know that sense of when you're talking to somebody and you feel like they're almost, they're just very open and they're not kind of pushing their sense of themselves and their views on you? And it's like you're talking to a gust of wind almost. And in that, there's a lot of freedom that comes for the person speaking. We can train ourselves to listen in a way that we're not exerting any of our egoic pressure on people. This is a big project, we could say, to learn to listen in this way, to learn to detect when we're getting clingy around something, when a subject comes up that triggers our own clinging, our own judging mind, our own jealousy, our own defensiveness, when it pushes the buttons of who we think we are, when we start to like stand guard at the gates of who we think we are. This happens all the time in conversation. Some point of clinging in us gets triggered. And so all of a sudden we have to do something to shore up our sense of selves or our views. And then we exert that pressure on people. We can actually learn to be sensitive to when clinging is arising and to relax, to receive it in awareness. And to let go in a way that we can just return to some sense of presence and openness and allow that person to be who they are, to share what they need to share. This is practice for us, a gift to a person and practice for us. But for me, it's been a really a great area of investigation. Like, to what am I attached? To what am I attached? And we can often use our bodies as the cue. There will almost always be some contraction in the body that is maybe more apparent than the thinking level. The body will contract when we start to cling in a conversation, whether we're speaking or listening. And as we learn to let go, we come into a really profound relation with somebody else. And can offer them something profound. And share a kind of a deep empathy that isn't possible when we're fixated on who we are or what our views are or what's true or what's right. Or it's just really open, really open. I'll just close with a quote here. This is from Chuang Tzu. If a man, and it's they use man here, but it could be either, of course. If a man is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in the boat, he will shout at him to steer clear. And if the shout's not heard, he'll shout again and begin cursing. And all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not be angry. If you can empty your own boat crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you, no one will seek to harm you. We can just sit for a moment before we end. You don't have to change posture wherever you are. So. Of sensing whatever goodness is present here. Remembering the goodness of your own heart. Remembering how deeply each being longs to be happy. Sensing into that may become very natural to wish that all beings be happy. And even knowing of war and oppression, and poverty, and even knowing of the cycles of birth and death in nature, even knowing all of this, we can affirm the wish, may all beings be happy. May all beings live with ease. May all beings be free from suffering. Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Thank you.